This is the Best of Game Time podcast. Highlights of today's 1620 The Zone's Game Time in bite-sized pieces. Hear Nick's entire past show on 1620thezone.com's Game Time podcast page and live 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. weekdays on 1620 The Zone, the 1620 The Zone app, and 1620thezone.com.
Hey guys, thanks for downloading the Best Up Podcast. On today's episode, we dive into Mike Riley's culture and my thoughts on Keyshawn Johnson Jr. getting popped for possession of marijuana and drug paraphernalia, and just my experiences of weed and athletics and how they mix, plus my reaction to Cleveland winning Game 4 and looking forward to Game 5, plus a really good conversation with ESPN's Kyle Peterson on the College World Series. Enjoy the podcast. Today, it'll be interesting to see where this conversation goes. I know Gary and Dame were talking about it, and Sip wrote about it. Let me first say this before getting into it. I got a variety of thoughts on this here. I've said this a bunch of times. I have a fairly progressive view on marijuana. Like, I mean, it's already legal in a few states. There are some studies that say it's safer than alcohol is. I think eventually it's... Like 50 years from now, future headlines, marijuana's legal, like, coast to coast. I can see it. Like, I could see it. I think there's, you know, ultimately because money motivates, and I think there's a lot of money to be made of legalizing marijuana. But I'm not interested in getting into that conversation. That's over on like a different station. But I know a handful of high functioning pot smokers, guys who are responsible, good people. I think we all know a few, right? I mean, but all I can do is bring things back to sports. Bring things back to athletics, and oftentimes I have to harken back to my experiences with things to be able to provide perspective, at least from where I'm basing my opinions. You know what I mean? Playing college basketball, covering college basketball, all that stuff. And I bring that up, obviously, is because you saw the story that broke over the weekend. Keyshawn Johnson Jr. got arrested on Friday, marijuana possession and drug paraphernalia, and this coming off the heels of Stanley Morgan and Antonio Reed getting popped for weed earlier in the month of May. And I just think there's an interesting conversation to be had on a variety of fronts. And you got to be careful here. Just because you get a DUI doesn't mean you're an alcoholic. Just because you get arrested for marijuana doesn't mean you have a major drug problem. So I do think before we embark on this conversation, you do got to be careful about painting with a broad brush on certain things. But again, all I can do is speak from my experiences and bring things back to sports, right? Because it's a sports talk show. And in my time of playing college basketball, covering college basketball to the point of having insider knowledge about individuals on certain teams, 99% of all the heavy weed smokers that I played with or know who were heavy weed smokers were all underachievers. I'm talking about the guys who smoked a lot. All those guys were underachievers. And I don't want to name names, but I could give you a list of a bunch of dudes who smoked a ton and just never maximized to their full ability. Little lazy, little irresponsible, little inconsistent, little out of shape. All those guys were all those things. And listen, I'm not saying that Stanley Morgan and Keyshawn Johnson Jr. and those guys are potheads or lazy underachievers. I'm simply saying, based on my experiences, the trend is overwhelmingly in that direction. And like I said, I have a progressive view on marijuana in society. You got to understand, there is society and then there's athletics. Those are two different worlds. There is, marijuana use if you sell insurance. And then there's marijuana use if you are a wide receiver for a Division I football team. Those are two different worlds. And in one world, the majority of dudes I know who are heavy, heavy weed smokers in the world of sports, they were the more lazy, underachieving types of guys. They weren't bad dudes, not saying that at all. I'm just speaking from my experiences and bridging the conversation into what this show is, and that's sports. So, hopefully, because like I said a little bit ago, you can't paint with a broad brush. Just because you get popped for a DUI doesn't necessarily mean that you're Denzel Washington in Flight. You know what I mean? Hopefully, Stanley Morgan and Keyshawn Johnson Jr. and those guys, they're not, you know, like heavy weed head users who are consumed by it. Because that typically doesn't end well the vast majority of the time based on my experiences. So I just think there's an interesting conversation to be had. And oftentimes things like this go back to priorities. You know what I mean? Like, it goes back to priorities for the individual. How important is football to you in relation to weed? How important is that locker room, those teammates, to you in relation to weed? How important are your coaches, the players that came before you, in relation to weed? And people show you with their actions the answer to those questions. You know what I'm saying? Like, people will let you know what's high on their priority list and what isn't based on their actions. And let me make it crystal clear. I don't want to try and insinuate that we need to push the code red button because of a couple weed busts or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm just speaking that, hey, you know, Nick, based on your experiences, what's the trend? Well, the trend is weed and heavy weed use and Division I athletes typically didn't necessarily maximize. You know, and sometimes I think little things can become big things, and the little things add up collectively. I'm not ready to go full-blown, let's call everything into question kind of a deal. I mean, Sip, in his column today, I thought, you know, he pointed out some interesting things. And in the spirit of little things add up and little things become big things. You know, you get a couple of drug arrests. You know, academic progress rate dropping from 6th to 8th in the Big Ten. And then I still go back to the fact that Nate Gary was academically ineligible for the bowl game is amazing. I mean, that's a captain, a senior captain. And so you go, all right, either Gary was a lazy, selfish guy, or nobody was holding that guy accountable. Either way, it's not good. And so I just think all this stuff is interesting. And Sip's column hit on a bunch of the stuff that's, you know, at the very least thought-provoking and a conversation starter. And again, I believe that little can become big, and little things add up collectively. And as Mike Riley has said, you gotta establish a culture of doing the right thing. As much as that sounds about as broad and it's pretty much all encompassing. Do the right thing. So it'll be interesting now. It'll be interesting now to see how, These drug arrests are handled. You know, are we talking about guys are going to have to do pencil rolls and do a bunch of sprints till they puke? Are they going to miss games? Are they going to, you know, what is this going to end up being? I don't know. And I don't necessarily know what the right answer is. But what I do know is, based on my experiences, and I'd imagine if you talk to Damon or Verz or Jason Peter or Jay Foreman, the vast majority of guys who were big, heavy smokers and were underachieving guys. Paul tweets in and says, just a question, but what about those that were heavy drinkers? Did you see the same outcomes? Honestly, I mean, obviously, I played with a lot of guys that were heavy drinkers, and so you have the heavy drinkers or the heavy weed users. The heavy weed users were usually the ones that were more lazy and underachieving. Now, I don't know what that means. And again, all I can speak to is relate these things back to sports and my experiences. Play with a lot of guys that love to booze. Play with a lot of guys who love to smoke. And again, the overwhelming trend in one direction is, you know, the guys that were heavy smokers never fully maximized. So if you listen to the show, I use a handful of hypothetical scenarios to maybe try and prove a point or look at something in a different way. I always got, these are some of the ones I give you. If someone would have told you blank before the season or game, what would you have said? The other one I always like to give is, if someone has been in a cave for a year and saw this, what would they think? Things like that. I think it's a different way to approach thinking about certain topics in sports and in life. I mean, you think about, if someone had told me 20 years ago I can listen to any song I want at any time, I would have been like, what? I mean, stop it, like that. What now? Remember the first actual mix CD you can make of like, what you're telling me I can have Tupac, Jay-Z, and Eminem all on one CD? Like, you were like, what now? Remember the first time you could pause live TV, rewind live TV? It was like, it's crazy. Or even now, I still, you know, whenever I'm doing traveling with Fox and I have a rental car, whatever, to me, it still is amazing to me that I can type in any address anywhere into like GPS and a voice will guide me every single turn to get me to my destination, whether I'm in Cincinnati or in Indianapolis. Like, that's amazing to me. But you get the point. But I like the cave hypothetical, just to see how you would view something without any other prior knowledge, because you've been in said cave. So here we go with this. Imagine someone that knows and understands basketball. So it's not like this person's going to come out of a cave and be like, basketball? What do you? Like, they know and understand basketball. And that person maybe has been living in a cave for like 10 years. They come out of the cave and you plop them in front of a television set and you have them say, okay, cave guy, you're going to watch all of these NBA playoffs, right? So this cave guy's sitting watching all the games, all the performances, all the way up until Friday night, you know, through game four, and now it's 3-1. Now imagine having to tell that person who's been in a cave, yeah, hey, LeBron James, yeah, he isn't the MVP of the NBA. No, he, in fact, he wasn't even in the final three. Oh, and by the way, Kyrie Irving, yeah, he wasn't first, second, or third team All-NBA. I mean, think about how shocked that person would be, how stunned they would be. Now, I don't necessarily want to revisit the whole MVP debate because I got tired, but I do think we may need to revisit how or when we vote for these awards. I think we either need to wait and include the playoffs for MVP voting and all NBA voting, or you know there are like all tournament teams and stuff. I think we maybe need to have like an all like a playoffs all NBA team. To me, it's a joke. It's a total joke to watch the entire playoffs and understanding that this is the basketball that matters the most. And the fact that LeBron James isn't the MVP and that Kyrie Irving didn't make any all-NBA teams is just dumb. I'm watching these playoffs and the finals, and every once in a while I have to say out loud to myself, LeBron James isn't even in the final three for the MVP. And when that's the case, something's maybe not right with how you're structuring or handing out your award. I mean, same thing with Kyrie Irving. He's been amazing in the playoffs. And the guy isn't first, second, or third team All-NBA. Like, if you can look at me and look me in the eye after all the games we've watched in the playoffs and say LeBron James isn't the most valuable player and that Kyrie Irving isn't one of the 15 best players in the NBA, you're absolutely nuts. You are totally insane. And even with Durant, imagine you'd be like, oh, cool. So wait, you told me this Durant guy and LeBron, you'd be like, LeBron's not the MVP. You go, oh, so it's Durant. I'm like, no, it's not Durant either. And those two guys weren't even in the final three? No, they weren't. Well, that's a pretty stupid way to hit. Yeah. Now, I get that Kevin Durant's been good. I don't know how you can watch these playoffs, and in particular the finals, and not think that LeBron James isn't just like definitely the best player in the NBA and the most valuable player in the NBA. I mean, he's got a positive plus minus for the series, and they're down 3-1. I mean, it's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. By the way, there was one of the headline moments going back to game four was the officiating error with regards to a technical foul in the first quarter. So a technical foul was called in the first half, and it appeared to be on Draymond Green. That's what was announced over the PA system in the arena. That's what was announced by Mike Breen and the guys on television. And most importantly, that's how it went into the official stat book. But then in the second half, when Draymond Green was whistled for what was thought to be a second technical foul, after a bunch of confusions, the ref said, no, that first technical foul was actually on Steve Kerr. So Draymond Green wasn't ejected. Now, to me, that whole thing was BS and a horrible look to me for the NBA and the officials. This is just, if the first technical foul went into the official scores book on Draymond Green, then it's on Draymond Green. Like, what's the point of the official scores book if it isn't official? And how on earth would the officials have not caught that at halftime? That a technical foul had been incorrectly administered on the wrong person? Like, how is that not something? That's a significant thing. Like, how is that not caught at halftime? I just thought the whole thing was an awful look. And however something goes into the book, that's how it is. Because here's the slippery precedent that sets, or the slippery slope you go on with that. Because I guarantee you this happens at times. Let's say if a foul in the second quarter was put in the official book on LeBron James, but it actually was on Kevin Love, would the refs, after a full halftime and quarter later, go back and say, no, that foul was on Love. That one on the baseline, that was on Love, not LeBron. You need to take one foul away on LeBron. Would they do that? No way they would do that. So I thought that whole thing was a really, really bad look. I just thought in general that the refs on Friday night were bad. The game they lost complete control of the game. There are way too many stoppages and reviews of things, and I thought a lot of things about Friday night and about game four were just handled really poorly. And by the way, so for the second straight year, a Golden State Warriors family member has insinuated that the officials have fixed the game. The fix is in. Remember last year it was Steph's wife, Aisha Curry, remember, tweeted after what is it, game three, maybe game three or game four, I can't remember which one of them, it might have been game six, it was game six, that the, you know, the NBA is rigged and all this stuff. Horrible look, right? Well, Draymond Green's mom has gotten into the action with this. She tweeted, during game four, these officials have been officially paid. Then tweeted, the ref takeover. I mean, for the second straight year, a family member, last year Steph's wife, this year Draymond Green's mom, tweeting that the fix is in. You know, these refs have been paid, the fix is in, the NBA is rigged. Come on, man. Like, that is such an immature, bad look. Second straight year that happens. I thought it was ridiculous last year. I think that comment's ridiculous. Come on now. The College World Series, baby. And when you hear this voice, you know it's College World Series time. He's Kyle Peterson of ESPN. KP, what's up, man? How you doing?
Hi, Nicholas. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Can I nerd out with you from a broadcasting standpoint real quick? How has the improvements for film study from a basketball standpoint as a broadcaster have, like, I mean, it's crazy to think about where we were 10 years ago to now and how I can watch every game and every, you know, I can watch every three-pointer that Kyrie Thomas makes, whatever. Give me baseball films, like, from your, when you prepare for a game, how much has it improved since you started ESPN?
Well, a ton. I mean, I'd say that the biggest improvement, and I think the easiest way to prepare for a game from my standpoint, is to try to look and see what guys have done immediately before that. So when we were doing Louisville the other day, I could go back and watch, you know, Sean Gelly's last three innings when he came in relief in the regional final. I could go watch McClure's previous start. I could go watch McKay's previous start. And I was doing it, I mean, up to the point that we were a half hour before on air, watching it on my phone.
Right, right.
So to have it be that immediate that I can go back to those previous appearances for everybody and see it immediately before we go on the air. And a lot of it just validates the stuff that you've either heard or thought or seen up to that point in the season. But yeah, it's so massively convenient now.
Right.
Honestly, there's really not many excuses from our standpoint.
Yeah.
There's no excuses not to see the other side before you get there because it's really easy to find it.
How do you study a pitcher? So you're trying to analyze, diagnose, get ready to call a game where a guy's going to go on the mound, going to get a start. Like, what? Take me into your mind. What are some things you're looking for when you dive into some, you know, looking at a guy's previous couple innings or whatever?
Well, I think, you know, you could look at the box score and figure out how many runs they give up, how many hits, how many extra base hits, how many walks, how many strikeouts. Generally, strikeouts is a pretty good indicator of what stuff was. Walks is clearly an indicator of location outside the zone. Sometimes hits can be a misleading number. And so when I go back and look at it, I want to see from a location standpoint, especially with a fastball, are the misses big misses, or the misses over the plate, or are they missing? If I'm trying to throw a fastball outside and I miss 4 inches off the plate, that's a pretty good place to miss because you're not going to get hit as much there. And so it's trying to figure out secondary stuff. Are we throwing secondary stuff 2-0, 2-1, or are we throwing secondary stuff always in plus pitchers counts?
Right.
And I'll take it even one step further. Kentucky, in scouting Brendan McKay this past weekend, the starter who could go first overall tonight, the Twins, Nick Mangione, head coach of Kentucky, said, we went back and looked at every start he had. And when hitters put the first pitch in play this year against Brendan McKay, they're 1-for-78.
Wow.
So we're not swinging at the first pitch. And that's what they did.
Yeah.
And so we had an idea going into it exactly what their scouting report was, but the reason for it was them going back charting on film saying, hey, there is a competitive disadvantage. A, the pitch count doesn't go up as fast. B, nobody's had success with this the whole year, so we're going to try to get deeper in the count.
Wow. That's amazing. Kyle Peterson's my guest. Hey, with a pitcher, KP, is less more with a pitcher from the standpoint of how many pitches they have in their back pocket to be able to use? Like, is it better to have – do you want to have a whole bunch of different pitches, or is less more?
I think you want to have good ones. And if that turns into two really good ones, then you ride with two most of the time. There's some days, I mean, there's days you go out there from a starting standpoint, you feel like you only have one.
Right.
And those are the ones you determine who can really pitch. Because if you go out and you have to just pitch the fastball for the most part. But the guys, as you move into pro ball, you know, the guys that are limited primarily to two pitches are generally guys that are limited to the bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest reason is when you turn a lineup over two, three times during the course of the game, if guys are only forced to look at two and your stuff starts to diminish a little bit as the ball game goes on, then clearly you're going to give up more hits.
Gotcha.
Case in point, Brendan McKay. So the whole reason that Kentucky tried to run the pitch count up was the vast difference in Brendan McKay's batting average against based on pitches. So pitches 1 through 40 in the game, he was essentially unhittable.
Right.
Pitches 41 through 80, he became human again. And 81 and after in the games they had charted, the other team was hitting 375. So their whole point was we need to get to that point. McKay has three pitches, but as the game went on, the stuff just diminishes enough, and guys have seen it enough, that's when they've started getting on it.
Gotcha. Kyle Peterson, ESPN. Hey, before we get into what we're going to see for the next couple of weeks, I want to quick go back and I want to get your take on Nebraska baseball. And, Darren Erstad's crew won a Big Ten conference title, which I think is great. I think we've gotten to the point where we don't appreciate and value winning your conference as much anymore in college football, basketball, and baseball, but struggled again in the postseason. How would you give me the state of the union for Nebraska baseball? How would you diagnose Darren Erstad's crew right now?
I think they're fine. I mean, I think that maybe the thing that has surprised me the last few years is offensively how much they've struggled when I got into the postseason. And I would say more so this year than last year. Just and listen, this is not doing a deep dive on Yale starter and Holy Cross starter.
Right.
They might have faced two guys that are going to pitch the big leagues. Full disclosure, I don't know those two clubs that well. But it did surprise me a little bit just that the offensive struggles were there in the postseason. But that being said, I mean, as far as state of the program, I think that people need to understand how hard it is to get into the postseason.
Mm-hmm.
Oregon State's the number one team in the country right now. They deserve to be the number one team in the country. They weren't playing in the postseason last year. North Carolina wasn't playing in the postseason last year. Both were two of the top teams in the entire nation. And I'm not comparing saying next year Nebraska's the top five team, but my point is to get into the postseason right now, with the parity that exists in college baseball is a very significant achievement in and of itself.
Totally agree. Hey, I'm curious, besides pitching, because I assume that's the answer, what's the biggest difference between the LSUs and Oregon States of the world and the schools like maybe Nebraska and Iowa?
Well, I think it's two answers. I think with Oregon State, it is pitching is a big component of it, but they also have, from a defensive standpoint, they're incredibly consistent. And they've got some impact position guys. I mean, Harrison's an impact position guy. Madrigal's going to play in the major leagues. He's, 5'7", 5'8". They have some guys that can hurt you. And I think the other thing with Oregon State is they're very comfortable playing the style of baseball that Pat thinks is the right style. They don't hit a lot of home runs, but they end up scoring a fair amount of runs. Clearly, the method works. With LSU is really dynamic offensively. And the one thing that LSU has that LSU generally doesn't have is seniors in very significant offensive roles. So usually the top teams in the country, those guys are done their junior year.
Mm-hmm.
LSU has Kramer Robertson back, Cole Freeman back. Dykeman was draft eligible last year. He comes back. Poche seems like he's been there for 15 years. Those guys have been, Poche pitches the game to get him to Omaha. Robertson, Freeman, Dykeman are usually hitting 1-2-4 in a lineup. So I think that the maturity that they have, and also the athleticism, because they're very, very good,
mm-hmm.
is one of the biggest differentiators for LSU this year.
Kyle Peterson is my guest. Kyle, got one more spot to fill, obviously, with the College World Series field. Florida, Wake Forest going at it. Who do you like there? Who do you think emerges there?
Well, I like Florida just because they won the first game.
Yep.
And the second one's tight enough. Now, Wake Forest can spin the script here pretty quick. If first guy that comes to hit today hits ball in a gap, and instead of a 5-4 lead, it's a 7-4 lead because they're going to come back with two guys on base. But Florida struggles when they have to score a bunch of runs. That's just historically when they've struggled this year. It is not as, offensively, Wake Forest is a better offense than Florida does. But Florida, from a pitching standpoint, has a clear advantage. And I think the biggest thing today is if Wake wins game two, to see what Florida does game three, because they could come back with Grady Singer. who's going to be a top 10 overall guy next year if he's healthy. He turned down a ton of money from the Blue Jays last year out of high school. They could potentially come back with Fieto. Two guys that threw game one but didn't throw 100 pitches in game one. Alex Fieto is going to hear his name called probably within the first 15 picks of the draft tonight. So if they do that, I think it spends clear advantage Florida in game three if they can't win game two. But Wake has an offense that, and they lead the country in home runs. They're the only team since B.B. Corbett did 100 home runs in a year. So it's an offense that can score runs in bunches. And a game three there, even though the advantage to Florida is on the mound, Wake can score runs in a hurry.
How distracting is it that you have the draft right before the College World Series?
Massively distracting. Yeah. I mean, think about Alex Fieto's day. Okay? So if they do lose game two, and if I don't think he would start game three, I think Singer would, but if Fieto potentially is going to pitch, and let me tell you what could happen during the course of the game. What could happen during the course of the game is he has to take a phone call. And he has to take a phone call from name your major league organization that says, Alex, we're picking at a 14th spot. We'll give you $2.9 million. Is that enough to sign?
Sheesh.
And that's the reality of the business right now, because from a major league standpoint, the way that all the slotting system works, you have a bucket of money, but you can spend that bucket of money in different areas. And if Fieto or anyone else is willing to take a certain number in a certain slot, it could greatly impact whether or not he's taken in that slot during the course of the draft. And it doesn't just go for him. It goes for anybody else.
Sure.
The difference is he's potentially playing in a game when that is going on.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, it's almost...
Well, it's sad.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It's sad, and that's unfortunate. It shouldn't happen.
No.
But it is amazing.
All right, KP, every year I ask you this, and your answer is my pick to win the College World Series. Who's got the best pitching staff? Is it Oregon State? Who's got the best staff here? Okay.
Yeah.
That's my pick. Just so you know, that's how deep I get into this thing. That's it. You're just I dive deep into your brain, and then you kind of set the tone for me. All right, that's pretty much.
Yeah, so deep that I gave you a one word answer. So that is deep.
That is just deep right there. Give me Dansby Swanson come here. We've had Jackie Bradley. Give me a stud. Give me a player I need to watch for starting this weekend that is going to be by the end of these 2 weeks, everybody's going to be talking about this guy.
I think you're going to love Nick Madrigal from Oregon State. He from a size standpoint, he's going to surprise you with the things he can do on the baseball field. The immediate comp is Pedroia just because of size, kind of the way they play the game. But I think the more that you watch Nick Madrigal play, and the reality is, Oregon State's not on TV a lot during the course of the year, so you don't see their guys very much. And their numbers are fake. I mean, no, in the history of Division I baseball, nobody has ever had this good of a winning percentage. In the history of the game,
they're
54-4 right now. And yes, obviously, pitching plays a main component because it's one of the most dominant pitching staff by numbers that we've ever seen, but there needs to be some offense, there needs to be some defense, and I think Madrigal's a guy that you're really going to like.
So with the field right now, lots of familiar faces, and with that you think of experience. Obviously experience matters on some level, but where does experience, like where does it manifest itself in the College World Series to matter, like getting specific with it?
When you lose.
Okay.
I think that's part of it. When you fall behind in an environment like that, I mean, the team that I think is going to get overlooked a little bit, I'm sure that they don't mind it, is the team that essentially returned everybody from last year, who was the preseason number one team in the country, who has kind of skipped through the postseason. And they've had some close games, don't get me wrong, but they haven't lost, and that's TCU. Oregon State, number one in the country. LSU brings a ton of flash. Florida has these incredible front-end arms that they end up getting there. And you look at TCU and you go, hold it, these guys were there last year? And it's essentially the same dudes. Now, Luckenbaker's not going to play. But besides that, it's the same arms.
Mm-hmm.
It's 7 of the 9 same offensive and defensive lineup. And they're a year older. If there's anybody that has, I would say, an experience advantage that comes into this field, I think it's absolutely that.
Kyle Peterson, ESPN. Kyle, does it feel good that you've got no more flights to get on, at least for the next couple of weeks? Does that make you happy?
It feels kind of weird. It's a good feeling. It's nice to be home for 2 weeks this time of year, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Kyle Peterson, ESPN. Kyle, I know you're busy. Appreciate your time, my man. Have a great couple of weeks. Hopefully we'll catch up during the next couple of weeks.
Hey, man. Sounds good. See you, buddy.
This is kind of how I view tonight. So game 5, Golden State up 3-1. And this, to me, it's officially a one-game series. That's it. Like, to me, if the Cavs win tonight, it's going seven. I just don't see Cleveland losing at home in game six. I just don't see it happening. I think that's just the reality of the deal right now. Like, if the Cavs win tonight, this thing is going seven. And then Cleveland will have 48 minutes to win it all in a place where they've done it before. I think that is the reality of the situation at hand. Can Cleveland find a way to win tonight? Can they do it? Vegas says not likely. Vegas puts the spread at about 8.5 in favor of the Warriors. But at the same time, Golden State was favored by 6 the other night and got blown out. So you never know. My gut says it ends tonight. That Golden State wraps this thing up. But at this point, I wouldn't put anything past LeBron. And the way Kyrie's played in the past two games, Kyrie really struggled in game two. He's 8 of 23. But the past two games, homeboy has been on. And what is kind of a frustrating thought, this is a thought that I couldn't help but kind of be on the top of my mind as I went to bed on Friday night after game four. Imagine if Cleveland wouldn't have collapsed in the final 3 minutes of game three and they would have won game three. I mean, this thing could be tied 2-2. Now, I get that if game three ends differently, then game four maybe goes differently too. But you get the spirit of what I'm saying. Where, like, if Korver's shot goes in the corner, this thing could be 2-2. And with that said, listen, this series could end tonight 4-1, and this will be hard to argue. But I'm curious, and I tweeted it out last night because I'm curious. Like, one of the things I'm not afraid to say, I missed on something or overreacted to something. Some people are like, go down with their, they're like, you know, go, oh, I will believe this to the. Sometimes you get things wrong, sometimes you get things right. Has the media maybe overstated just how much better Golden State is than Cleveland? And I'm guilty of pushing that chatter. I'm guilty of it. But I'm curious, after four games, what do you guys think? Because I can honestly see it both ways. I can see both sides of it. Because on one hand, you can say, absolutely. I mean, look, Cleveland's two possessions away from this thing being 2-2. And how far are they really away if the thing's tied 2-2? But at the same time, on the other hand, you can say, well, Golden State blew out Cleveland in games one and game two. And the bottom line is they won game three. Whether you want to peg it as a collapse, you can certainly paint it as that Golden State was amazing at the end of that game and found a way to win. And then probably lastly, you could say, man, it took a record-setting offensive performance, historic performance from Cleveland for them to win game four. Most points in a quarter, most points in a half, most three-pointers ever in the finals for them to win a game. They're not close. I can honestly see both sides of it. Now, I think the truth is always towards the middle a bit. That's kind of the nature of the world we're in today is we go on extremes. You know, like just 4 or 5 days ago, people are talking about, is this the greatest team of all time? This Golden State team. And now some people are saying, oh, 3-1, look out. So it's like we kind of sway with the wind a little bit of what's happening in the media. I try to be better than that, but sometimes I'm not. I just wonder, and maybe because it's eerily similar how the series last year played out, and this year is how maybe LeBron is a little bit like one of those boxers that needs a few rounds to kind of feel you out, size you up, and then attack. Because it feels like every single minute that has passed in this series, Cleveland's kind of steadily gotten better. And steadily, not figured out Golden State, because they certainly haven't figured out Golden State. But I think they're They're a little bit smarter offensively, defensively. And so maybe we've all, me included, maybe we've kind of overstated for dramatic purposes just how much better Golden State is than Cleveland. I don't know. Like I said, I think you can build a compelling case either way. You can build a case that says, man, this thing is one possession away from being 2-2. You can also build the other side of the argument that Golden State isn't close. So, like I said, I think I would love nothing more to see Cleveland win. I would love nothing more to just get more of what have been. These games have been wildly entertaining. I mean, the level of basketball, the level of skill on the floor. I don't think I've ever watched a series where there's about 10 to 15 plays a game that truthfully drop my jaw. Whether it's Durant, Steph, Kyrie, or LeBron, there's about 10 to 15 plays a game that, in particular, those four guys make that I'm just like, wow, is that amazing. And so selfishly, I just want to keep this thing going, not only because I want LeBron to win, but I want to keep on watching this. I think it would be fascinating to see. Because you know, we talk about how good Golden State is, all this stuff. I want to see them get put, like, let's see how these guys react. Let's see how these guys react. Cause some people would say, hey, you wonder if the ghosts of 3-1 is circling in those guys' head of, you know, the whole, cause I asked Steve Kyler this question, where the pendulum of pressure is at right now and confidence and momentum. It's hard to say that the team that's down 3-1 has momentum and confidence, but like in a weird way, feels like there's a lot of pressure on Golden State tonight, doesn't it?
I think that's without question. And the first warning sign for them that I noticed after game four was, I mean, I know for a fact Draymond said it a few times. I think Steve Kerr said it. I think Steph said it, but they kept repeating that 3-1 thing. Yeah. And they were saying it in the spirit of, you know, people are going to bring up 3-1. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just focused on the next game, blah, 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 you know, at player speak. But the fact that they kept saying it, like, kind of told me, you know what's going on here.
Yeah,
you know what happened.
If it's top of mind, you're thinking about it. You know,
they're probably thinking about it before game four.
It's weird. Like, it makes no sense. The team that's up 3-1, it feels like there's a lot of pressure. Feels like there's a lot of pressure on Golden State tonight.
And look, I'm not saying that, like, coming back from a 3-0 deficit is something that's easily done, because it happens in hockey all the time, but that's a different sport. But the only time that I can really remember it happening on a stage like this is the 2004 Red Sox. So that tells you how rare it is.
Right.
But if you actually map it out, all Cleveland had to do, get one game at home, find a way to fight and claw and get one game on the road in a place that you've won at before.
Right.
And then you turn around, you get another home game, and then anything can happen seven with the best player in the world.
That's what I mean, it feels like Cleveland's got to be telling themselves, man, we just got to find a way to win one game. And then we are going to, I think Cleveland will win game six. And then all of a sudden it is 3-3, one game, winner takes all. And I know in that scenario, as good as Golden State has been, I'm not betting against LeBron in that scenario. I'm not.
I mean, it was the same thing. I mean, without having the best player in the world, it was the same thing for those 2004 Red Sox that pulled this off. If you've seen the 30 for 30, you know, with Bill Simmons about that Red Sox team. I can't remember which Red Sox player said it, but obviously all of Boston was done with that series when they fell down 3-0. Everybody was doubting them. Nobody thought they had a prayer. But one of their players said, look, we grab tonight at home, then anything can happen.
Yeah.
Because the Red Sox had another home game, because that was back when the championship series was 2-3-2. So they steal a couple at Fenway. Then they get a couple on the road. It's the same deal with this series. It seems like a mountain for these Cavaliers to come back from this hole, but if you actually break it down by game, it's not impossible.
They just got to win tonight. To me, they win tonight, this thing goes seven. This thing, watch, like I will, I'll make, if they win tonight, they'll be favored in game six.
Oh, yeah.
And so all you got to do is win tonight. Anything can happen. So it is interesting. You know, I do urge everybody to go check out Steve Sipple's column today. It's just thought provoking on kind of the culture of Riley's program and how Nebraska football has become very, very partisan. Like what side of the aisle you are on skews how you view something. Like in some ways, Nebraska football is almost like one of those inkblot tests, or even like, you ever remember when you were like little, you'd look up at like a cloud and your friend would be like, oh, I see a lion. No, I see a bird. Or was it like you're going to see what you want to see depending on what side of the aisle you're on? You anti-Bo, you see things this way. You're pro-Riley, you see things this way. And I always tell people think I'm anti-Nebraska. I'm not anti-anything. I'm pro-good football. I'm pro-winning programs. That's what I am. Whatever goes towards that, that's what I'm about. That's what I support. That's what I will praise. But the one thing I get concerned about, if we're being real, if we can just be real, the one thing I get concerned about is physically, Nebraska isn't even close to Ohio State, Bama, and Clemson. Just physically. Just in terms of bodies, athletes, depth of those athletes and bodies, not close right now. That's not a hot take. I think we'd all agree with that. And as Nebraska builds towards that, they do need to be damn near flawless mentally to make up for some of that stuff. They got to be elite there. And that isn't just understanding their assignments in the 3-4 and all that stuff. That is in everything. Decision-making off the field, in the offseason. Doing what you got to do academically. Again, I think it's not a good look when your senior captain, Nate Gary, is academically ineligible for the bowl game. You got a bunch of impressionable, young guys on that roster, and they're going to follow the tone set by the leaders and the upperclassmen. And you got a guy, Nate Gary, just saying, I mean, he sends a message to those young guys, hey, I'm going to class, eh. But you got to be flawless mentally, killing yourself in the weight room, eating perfectly, taking care of your body, being a good teammate, all that stuff. Those are the things Nebraska has to be perfect at right now. Like there is a zero margin for error approach with that stuff. And sometimes I just like Sip was talking about in his column today, sometimes you kind of wonder where that's all at with Nebraska football. You know, how strong is Mike Riley's culture right now? On every, you know, off season, in practice, weight room, in a game, decision making, academics, weight, like all of it. How strong is it? I don't know. I think there's probably isn't a big enough sample size to draw any conclusion if we're being fair. There is some evidence that says, not great. Then there's some evidence that would point to Nebraska taking steps and strides in the right direction. I just think, you know, we throw on words like culture a lot when discussing Nebraska. And you got to remember, culture is all encompassing. All 100 dudes doing what's best for the team and best for the program at all times. You know, and we talk about upgrading the physical talent on the roster. We talk about that all the time. And I agree that that needs to be done. But I do think we rarely talk about where the mental aspect of the program is at. How healthy is it? Does it need a makeover? Is it trending in the right spot? Is it in a good spot? Because for as much as you want to say all that matters is talent, got to get dudes, need 4- and 5-star guys. And again, while I agree with the assertion that the talent that you acquire on a roster is vital, having the right people in your program and the right culture is vital too. And I just think you can't lose sight of that. So I'll be really, really interested. And I know John and Josh this afternoon are going to talk a ton about this because they have a poll question on what the punishment should be, or how Mike Riley should handle some of these marijuana busts that have happened between, you know, Antonio Reed and Stanley Morgan and now Keyshawn Johnson Jr. It'll be interesting to see how Mike Riley handles it moving forward.
Thank you for listening to today's Best of Game Time podcast. Hear Nick's entire past show on 1620thezone.com's Game Time podcast page and live 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. weekdays on 1620 The Zone, the 1620 The Zone app, and 1620thezone.com.